Hello, friends, and welcome to Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. Today is part two of our two-part mini-series on the Ten Commandments. Last week, we discussed commandments 1 through 4, which all address how we are to relate to God. Today, we'll take an in-depth look at commandments 5 through 10, which all address how we are to relate to one another. Now, maybe you think the Ten Commandments are dull, restrictive, boring, and straightforward enough that there isn't a lot to learn about them. Well, I used to think that too. But I have since discovered that they are, in fact, more challenging, life-giving, and deeper than they first appear. We're honored to be joined once again today by Todd Pruitt, lead pastor at Covenant Presbyterian Church in Harrisonburg. Welcome back, Todd.
Thanks, Rita.
Ready for part two?
Sure.
All right.
Well, Todd, just as a recap from last week, I really have two questions to take us into this week's program. Do the Ten Commandments still apply today? And if so, what is their role in our lives? And is it fair to say that if everyone in America and around the world knew and obeyed the Ten Commandments, we would all be safer and happier than we are today?
I don't think there's any question that even when an unbeliever lives in accordance with the Ten Commandments to the extent that he or she is able. You know, they can only conform outwardly to those things because they're not regenerate. But again, who could argue that if all of our neighbors were committed to never stealing and never committing adultery and never lying and never coveting, you know, who could argue that that wouldn't make people typically, generally, more happy? It wouldn't do anything to save their soul, but it would be a positive and good thing in terms of making it a more just and honorable society.
Well, that would be our goal then, wouldn't it, Rita, yeah, in the program today? How can we do this?
Well, sure. And going back to something Dean just brought up, I think before we even get into the specific commandments, we have to address the question, which you did somewhat last week, but do these commandments still apply today? And what is their role in our lives? Because I think some people say we just need to be nice to others,
right,
and that's all we have to do.
Yeah, we would say that the Ten Commandments, God's moral law, are eternally binding. They're eternally binding upon all people. And in fact, even those who reject Christ are still accountable to God's moral standard. And when we say that they are eternally binding, we're not saying that people are saved by the law. No one is saved by the law. But we are saying that God's holiness hasn't been diminished at all just because we're sinners. And his expectation for how we should live hasn't changed. So we are still accountable to the law. Again, not for the salvation of our soul, but we are accountable to God. God is still God, and we are still his creatures.
That's very helpful. Thanks. Well, the commandments we'll be discussing today, dealing with how we behave toward others, are the ones that I think most people think of first when they think of the Ten Commandments. Even though they aren't the first ones in the list, they're the second half of the list. And I think the reason that people think of them first is because they line up with this fairly universal concept of morality, and also because they seem to establish pretty simple black and white rules that seem doable to us at first blush, at least. Would you agree with that? And why do you think that bright line rules, you know, do not steal, are so appealing to us?
People are born legalists. They want to be made right by their own behavior. And so even, you know, people who reject Christ, they will tend to gravitate it to one degree or another to what we would call that second table of the law. Now, the first table of the law governing our relationship with God, they reject entirely as hopelessly irrelevant.
Yeah.
But they still want to think of themselves as good persons. And isn't it interesting that even though they might deny God, they cannot escape the fact that God has written his law upon their conscience so that they know, for instance, that murder is wrong. The adulterer knows that adultery is wrong. And so people at the end of the day want to be able to say, I'm a good person. And even if they don't know God at all and have rejected Christ, they go back to some of those basic moral categories that God has written on their heart that are reflected there in the Ten Commandments.
Yeah. Even atheists would want to adhere to most of these commandments as this code of morality. Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I'm a good person.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, Todd, we've got a few to cover here, so let's get started with the first one. Mm-hmm. And that would be commandment number 5. Mm-hmm. We're going back to Exodus chapter 20. And that commandment reads like this: honor your father and your mother, so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. And it's been called the first commandment with promise. So what does it mean to honor one's father and mother, and why does this one commandment come with a promise?
Yeah, God is establishing that basically charity begins at home. As we think about loving our neighbor, it begins with the neighbor that is closest to us, which is our immediate family. And one of the ways, one of the chief ways that a child loves his mother and father is through giving them due respect and due honor. And it was so serious at that time, and attached with this blessing at that point, you know, the blessing of you know, God saying, I'm going to keep you secure in this land I'm giving you, because as the family goes, so goes the nation. And if there was going to be a pattern of rebellion within the home, that was eventually going to be reflected in a downgrade of the security of the nation. And so God took very seriously, because he cared about the security and blessing of his people in Canaan, he took very seriously the condition of the home, the condition of the family. So children, you're expected to do this. It was reflected in the civil laws as well. At that time, incorrigible children could be stoned if necessary. So it was very sobering and intended to be.
So that punishment, though, you would say that was part of the civil law, which isn't in effect.
Correct.
But the moral law,
the moral expectation remains. Exactly. One of the things that does is it establishes this pattern of honoring authority that God has established. So it begins in the home as a child learns to obey and honor their parents. But it continues because, you know, as Christians, we are people under authority. We're under the authority of God. We're to honor the civil authorities that God has established. We're to honor the authorities that God establishes in the church. And again, this isn't a blind adherence to injustice. If that authority calls us to disobey God, then we must choose to obey God rather than to obey man. But if the civil authority, for instance, even the unbelieving pagan civil authority, is not demanding that we disobey God, then we honor them. We are to obey in every way that we're able to obey and still remain faithful to God.
Well, you know, last week we touched just a little bit on how these commandments, all of them, are given to us by a loving God in his love for us, and they are for our good. And I just think about how different our society would look today if people actually kept this command, and all of them really, but this is just a great example of that.
You can see a lot of immediate tangible effects from a disregard for this law. Yeah, you know, one of the things that I would always tell my kids when they were younger is, listen, here are your rules for this household. Obey mom and dad and be happy. And the second thing always flows from the first thing. You know, obey mom and dad and be happy. And that's just one of those things you have to teach a child, because they come out of the womb looking to disobey.
Yes.
Well, this is a subject that we can go on for the rest of the program, and that and that is the problem of the broken home. Because not all children have a father and a mother that they can honor.
Right.
And it's so, again, it's probably a two-edged sword, isn't it? It is imploring parents to be worthy of honor.
And to
then
establish
for the
that
children.
Pattern in the home, you betcha. And if you look across America, the most dangerous individuals in our country are young men raised without fathers.
Yes.
And we need good parents. We need moms and dads who are together.
Yes.
And who are in the home with their children.
And as parents, when we do not train our children to keep this commandment in our homes, we are doing a great disservice to them.
Exactly.
It really starts with us teaching them.
Right. Parents, you are not your child's buddy.
Yeah.
Love them. Have a close relationship with them, but you have friends your own age.
Mm-hmm.
It really goes back to last week's program. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and might. If parents will do that, the children will see that, they will learn from it, and you will have a happier home. Wow, we could keep going on with this.
We could, but we need to move
yes,
on to number 6,
yes.
And it is a biggie.
Yes.
You shall not murder. Maybe this is the quintessential one. First of all, looking at just the text itself, what does it actually forbid? And I guess what I'm getting at with this is, does it encompass abortion? Does it encompass capital punishment? What about killing in a war situation?
Right. Well, and that's why do not murder is a better translation of the Hebrew than simply thou shalt not kill. And the reason is because the Hebrew language has at least six words for killing, which all kind of apply to a specific situation. And some killings are justifiable morally and some are not. What the sixth commandment, what the word in the sixth commandment prohibits is unjust taking of a human life. There is a different word in Hebrew for various just takings of a human life, such as in capital punishment, in just war. Those were times when it was morally justifiable to take a life. And that's made clear in the scriptures as well. But what we are to avoid with great zeal is the unjust taking of human life, because humans are made in the image of God. They have something that nothing else in all creation has. In fact, God calls for capital punishment in certain situations, particularly murder, precisely because murder is the slaying of an image bearer of God. And so some people will, pacifists and others will say, no capital punishment because people are in the image of God. Well, actually, in God's economy, no, that is why you reserve the right and the necessity of capital punishment in certain cases, because life is so precious. Yes. And of course, we would also say this governs our attitudes towards the unborn as well. Because from the moment of conception, one of the things that the Bible teaches every single time the Bible addresses life in the womb, it assumes the full humanity of that life every time, both Old Testament and New Testament. And therefore, those lives which are particularly vulnerable must be protected.
And so I would assume that extends also to euthanasia.
Absolutely.
We protect life at every part of the spectrum.
Yep, yep. And one of the things that Jesus teaches us, as well as the prophets, is to take special care to those, particularly who are most vulnerable. Well, who is more vulnerable than those that are within the womb and those who are aged and unable to do all the things for themselves that they used to be able to? And what a tragedy it is that we live in a country that is increasingly hostile towards those that are most vulnerable. We look over at Scandinavian nations and even some of our own states like Oregon, where the sick and the elderly and the depressed are being killed by doctors.
Well, just to be sure that we put this into context, over 60 million unborn babies have been destroyed in the womb since 1973, the Supreme Court decision. And I just see that as the most deplorable scar on the conscience of America. How will we ever be able to justify that to future generations?
Yeah, we won't. I pray that a day will come, if the Lord tarries, where a future generation in America looks back the way we look back at chattel slavery, or the way many modern Germans look back at the Nazi era. I hope, if the Lord tarries, I hope that will happen. And I will say this, that 20-somethings are more, quote, pro-life now than 20-somethings were in the 1970s, as far as I want it to be. But there has been a clear advance there.
With the help of science.
Yes.
Science has been huge in this.
Now, Todd, this commandment against murder is one that most of us can say we've kept perfectly. Or at least we could have said that until Jesus came along and rocked our world.
Right.
How did Jesus change our understanding of this commandment?
Yeah, so Jesus intensifies it. He does not allow us to hide behind a legalistic justification for saying, you know, I've never committed the act of murder, because Jesus in Matthew chapter 5 in the Sermon on the Mount makes it very clear that to hold on to anger in our hearts is essentially a violation of the sixth commandment. And so we're guilty of that. And again, this is where we see one of the purposes of the law. It holds up a mirror to us and drives us to Christ. Who can, if they look at their own heart, deny that they've held anger and bitterness? Well, Jesus says that's a violation. And again, that's intended in part to drive us to his grace and to be reminded again how much we need him. Because We've all violated it.
Well, there's something similar in our next commandment, mm-hmm. where Commandment 7 forbids adultery. Now, how would this have been understood in Moses' day? And I think we'll probably talk about how it can be understood today.
You know, on the one hand, it would have been understood the same way we understand it today in terms of violating the sanctity of marriage by seeking sexual intimacy outside of the bonds of marriage, which, you know, raises questions about, well, you know, doesn't the Bible allow for, you know, polygamy? You know, David had lots of wives, Solomon had multiple wives. Well, a couple of thoughts real quick on that. First of all, the Bible never once prescribes polygamy. It never says it's great to have multiple marriages. It describes it. It says that it happened. It records historically that it happened. But find me one place in the Bible where it describes a happy ending to that. And so we have to differentiate between what is prescribed in the Bible and what is described in the Bible. Now, was God patient with some of those Old Testament saints who carried over ancient practices of polygamy? Yes, you know, God is really gracious, and he bore with a lot of the frailties of his Old Testament saints, just like he bears with so many of our frailties. But polygamy was never sanctioned by God. God had a perfect opportunity to sanction polygamy in the garden, but he didn't. One man, one woman. The fact that some of the Old Testament saints messed it up is not a license for us to continue to do that. It never went well. It's not God's plan. And we have the fuller revelation of the full Bible to help us see that more clearly than Solomon did.
I'm really glad that you brought that up, because I have to say, as a woman, as a wife,
yes.
from the time I read the scriptures as a child, this always bothered me. It
right.
seemed so unfair
uh-huh.
that they would have gotten away with doing this and, you know, this kind of treatment of women. But you're saying God never
no.
approved of that.
It's never sanctioned. It's never prescribed. And again, if you look at the lives, you know, look at Solomon and ask him how polygamy worked out. It never worked out well, because it was never the design that God had. Again, God was merciful, and God patiently bore with those Old Covenant saints.
As but we all need God to bear patiently with us today.
Yes, indeed. So we want to say that the Bible does not advocate for or prescribe or design or excuse polygamy, and so in a way, you know, in that sense, the sixth commandment meant for those people gathered at Sinai the very same thing it means for us. But also, to your point, Jesus does the same thing with the sixth commandment as he does with the fifth commandment, which is he goes right to the heart and says, look, you can't hide behind a strictly legalistic, if you like, definition of this, but it goes to the heart as well. And we can violate the sixth commandment by our thoughts. We can violate the sixth commandment in our heart when we look lustfully upon someone else. And so there again, we see that the law governs not only our outward actions, but our thoughts and our attitudes and our motives as well.
So it's not just a legal act that we're talking about, as would be the case with polygamy,
mm-hmm.
but the multiple liaisons.
Absolutely.
And pornography.
Yep.
It is so clear that pornography is addictive, it is progressive,
sure.
and it is destructive.
Yes.
It is not an innocent act without a victim.
No, it's not, and it's a public health issue as well.
Yes.
You know, that's a soapbox I could get on for a while.
Yes.
Because the science is clear on this. It changes our brains, and it changes the way, although I was going to say men are the most frequent users of pornography. One of the things, though, that has certain social scientists very concerned, though, is that women and young women are more and more using pornography, which we never thought would be an issue. But of course, it makes sense. It makes sense that would begin to happen as well. But it changes the way people think. It changes the way they feel. It changes the way they treat one another. It hardens hearts.
We have normalized the exploitation of women.
Sure. And what it does is it undermines our ability to love people and treat them with dignity.
Yes.
Because we can't use them for our gratification and love them as we love ourselves at the same time.
Before we move on, from adultery. One more thing on this. I know that there are people today, many of them churchgoers, mm-hmm. many of them even professing believers, sure. who get married and then later on they are quote unquote unhappy, yeah. and they yeah. decide that, well, God surely means for me to be happy, so the best thing for me to do is get divorced and try to find that perfect soulmate that I haven't found yet. Does this commandment deal with that?
Yeah, you know, again, part of the breadth of application for this commandment is that husbands and wives, you shall love each other. You shall be committed to each other and remain committed to each other. And what's interesting is that, you know, divorce is allowed. God allows divorce. That was stated in the Old Testament and reaffirmed in the New Testament. And what's interesting about that is that we're told in Scripture, in Malachi, that God hates divorce. But isn't it interesting that he allows divorce because there's something he hates even more, which is adultery? He will allow divorce in cases of adultery because adultery is such a profound violation of the covenant between husband and wife. That said, we must never pursue divorce because, quote, I'm not happy. And I understand that there are some messed up marriages, but Scripture is very clear that we don't abandon a marriage for these kinds of self-seeking reasons.
Yeah, and aren't we told in the New Testament, too, that for a spouse to leave the other and just to pursue another spouse is actually committing adultery and,
yes.
and causing the other spouse to commit
yep,
adultery?
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. Number eight, the eighth commandment prohibits stealing. Is this one as simple as it sounds, or does it encompass more than just shoplifting or taking another person's property?
Yeah. You know, the Westminster Confession of Faith is great because it goes into detail of all that is prohibited in the command not to steal. And there's all kinds of things we steal, you know, whether it's a student stealing answers to a test or people's ideas or own words for a paper, people stealing the affection of another, you know, that's part of what adultery is it's robbery, it's stealing as well. When we think about all of the different ways that we can steal, we see that there's a great breadth here. And again, we would look at that at face value and say, you know, as long as we think of stealing in terms of, you know, just kind of the most egregious acts of armed robbery or burglary, then it's really easy to justify yourself here. But there are all kinds of subtle ways that we steal. When we steal people's time, when we steal affections, when we steal ideas and other people's work. You know, you think about students in a class taking an exam, and they can just text answers back and forth to each other while they're giving an exam. And the easier that kind of stealing becomes, the easier it is to justify. And before you know it, a young person can be 22 years old, having gone through school, and they've become an inveterate thief. Which is a really scary thought, how we can kind of damage our conscience that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, Todd, you mentioned Malachi just a minute ago, but Malachi also addresses this, and I hadn't thought of it quite this clearly. We steal when we rob God of our tithes and offerings. And I'm sure you will appreciate that in your stewardship sermons.
Yeah. We steal when we refuse to be generous the way God has called us to be generous. And so if I'm aware, for instance, of a need in the life of one of my brothers or sisters in Christ, and I've got the ability to meet that need, but I refuse to, I harden my heart against that. The Westminster Confession of Faith would call that stealing. When we refuse the generosity that God has given us the resources to share. On the positive side, the commandment not to steal is a command also to be joyfully generous, to give as God has given us means and resources to do so.
Well, Todd, we have two more, and we have just a little time left. Commandment 9 says, "You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor." Now, one might assume that this is referring to perjury in court because it uses the word testimony.
Right.
But is there more to it? What is this one all about?
You know, you mentioned that very first obvious application is, look, we have to have a solid, sound, trustworthy legal system. And again, God's building a nation there at Sinai. He's instituting things that will ensure that they have a just and secure society. So we need, everybody needs to be able to have confidence in the judicial system. But like all the laws in the Ten Commandments, there's a breadth to their applications. And it goes beyond just simply avoiding perjury. But saying anything about someone else that is not true. You know, we think about all the ways that we can violate the truth through exaggerations, through partial truths or half-truths. You know, a half-truth is a whole lie. Through stating something that might technically be true, but because it's removed so far out of context, it ends up being misleading. And we've all seen that happen. And so that ninth commandment governs our speech in such a way that we want to be meticulous in being truthful. We want to avoid anything that would harm our neighbor's reputation. Again, go back to what it immediately concerns, false testimony in court. What are we doing? We're harming our neighbor's reputation. We want to guard our neighbor's reputation in the ordinary walk of life as well. And we want to be people of truth. God is a God of truth. We want to honor and love what is true and hate what is false.
Well, Todd, the final commandment is about coveting, and it actually gets quite specific in listing things that we are not to covet. It says, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male or female servant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. What is coveting, and how does this commandment fit with the others?
Yeah, coveting is the desire to have something that doesn't rightfully belong to you. And isn't it interesting that this is the first law that doesn't mention a particular action, but goes straight to our thoughts, straight to our heart. And in that way, it kind of wrecks any idea that we might be able to be justified by obedience, because this reminds us that God's expectation goes deep into our heart, into our motives. You know, coveting oftentimes happens like a physical reflex. Even before we know it, we find ourselves coveting. And in that moment, we've broken the law. You know, this has a lot to do with contentment, being content with what God has given us so that we don't lust after the things that our neighbor has. And we can break this law by wanting good things. Everything that is listed by God in that commandment are in and of themselves good things. It's just the sinful desire to have those things. Yeah, you know, once again, the Ten Commandment drives it home by going straight to our heart and revealing how much we need God's mercy.
Yeah, on that note, as we get ready to close, when I judge my own heart attitudes, words, and actions according to the standard created by the Ten Commandments, what I realize is that I am a lawbreaker. I think anyone who's being honest would say the same thing. So what are the implications of that, and how can we have hope in the midst of knowing that?
You know, right after the law is announced, and the Tenth Commandment is verse 17 of chapter 20, it's followed immediately by the people's cry to Moses saying, you talk to God on our behalf. They are so terrified by that moment, the appearance of God on the mountain and the giving of his unwavering law, that they say, hey, we need a mediator. We need a go-between. And in that moment, Moses says, do not fear. These laws have come to you. You're to keep the fear of the Lord before you so that you'll obey. And then we're told, and Moses went into the thick darkness where God was. In that moment, God is showing that he has supplied a go-between. He has supplied a mediator, one who will come before him on behalf of the people. And of course, in that moment, Moses is pointing forward to Christ, which is what Jesus did for us. Ultimately, Moses could only be a provisional mediator. What we needed was a mediator who could die for our sins, one who would go into the thick darkness of Good Friday on that killing ground outside of Jerusalem and hang upon a cross and shed his blood for us. That's the mediator that our soul needs. And every time we look at God's moral law, we want to be reminded of what Jesus did for us in obeying the law and carrying its curse on our behalf.
Well, thank you, Todd, for being with us, especially for this review of God's Ten Commandments on how we are to live in our relationship with him and with each other. If you would like to listen to this program again or share it with your friends, go to our website, valleyfamilyforum.org, and click on the link to Crossroads on the home page. We want to thank our generous sponsors at Blue Ridge Chimney Services and the dental practice of Scott Dunaway, and also to so many of you for your prayers, your encouragement, and your financial support. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation to help keep Crossroads on the air, you can do so by check to Crossroads, P.O. Box 881, Harrisonburg, 22803. I'm Dean Welty with Rita Dunaway and engineer Robbie Meadows, inviting you to join us again next week at the Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. Until then, have a great week, putting your faith into action.
Rejoice, rejoice, rejoice,
rejoice, rejoice, rejoice, rejoice, rejoice,
rejoice, rejoice.
Let us rejoice.